Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Meet the Candidates. I'm your host, Jonathan Grabowski. We are talking State Senate today, and joining me on the show is the candidate, the independent candidate for the State Senate seat for the district, Stephen Gill. Hey, Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So we're going to talk about a bunch of issues and, you know, the race itself. But first off, who is Stephen Gill?
Well, I'm a father of two. I have two daughters. One is in her sophomore year at the University of West Virginia right now. And my youngest daughter is here in Marshfield, just entered her senior year. So both of my girls have gone through the Marshfield public school system. We've been all right here locally, actually, with Martinson Elementary, Furnace Brook Middle, and now the high school. All right in one convenient location.
Are you from the area originally?
Yeah, I grew up in Hull. My family's actually from Hingham. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Hull. I've got relatives all over the South Shore. Two of my, I'm actually the youngest of nine children. Two of my oldest sisters, actually my oldest sister and one of my other older sisters have lived in Marshfield, both of them, for over 40 years, raised their families here and everything. I had a little different path. As you know, I was a lieutenant commander in the Navy and Navy Reserve JAG Corps. Mm-hmm. And so I have lived in various locations, you know, around the globe, around the country. And before we finally relocated to Marshfield, we actually had been living in Florida for a number of years and came to Marshfield, I want to say it was 2010, I think it was, when we came back. But I've always been in
the district.
Yeah, South Shore, exactly.
So I know a little about the JAG Corps. A friend of mine's in the Army JAG Corps. But for those that don't know about the JAG Corps, what does it consist of?
Right. Well, the JAG, J-A-G is an acronym. It stands for Judge Advocate General's Corps. And all the branches of the military have a JAG Corps, with the exception of the Marine Corps, because the JAG Corps is a corps of the Navy, just as the Marine Corps is a corps of the Navy. But the Marine Corps actually has law specialists, but they're not called judge advocates because there is no Judge Advocate General's Corps for the Marine Corps. Kind of unified with the Navy. The Coast Guard also has a JAG Corps. We're basically the lawyers for the Navy, and we're also the lawyers for individual service members, retirees, dependents on various issues.
And you also are the former Deputy Secretary and General Counsel for the Department of Veterans Services. Just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, right. So during the Deval Patrick's administration from 2010, I had just gotten back from Afghanistan. I actually had been mobilized on active duty and was in the Washington, D.C. area, and I was dealing with the detainees down in Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. So I was frequently flying back and forth from D.C. to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. I actually stayed down in Guantanamo for 3 or 4 months during that time. And when I came back to D.C., my mobilization was almost up. And then they had put out a message. They asked if anybody wanted to volunteer to go to Afghanistan to do some detainee administrative prosecutions at Bagram Airfield. And so I volunteered to do that. They extended my mobilization for a period of 6 months, and then I ended up going to Afghanistan. So I had a little bit of a world tour, all in one little tour, so tour of duty.
Excellent. And you're in private practice now?
Yeah, I haven't actually been practicing lately. I'm really focusing on this Plymouth and Norfolk District senatorial race. Yeah. And just for the viewers' knowledge, the Plymouth and Norfolk District are the eight towns that consist of Weymouth, Hingham, Hull, Cohasset, Scituate, Marshfield, Norwell, Duxbury. Did I miss anybody?
I think you got everyone. It's a big district. So why are you running, and why this seat?
Well, you know, throughout my whole professional career, I have always been in public service. I love public service. I think that it is it's a higher calling for people who, you know, serve in the government, whether it's the federal government as a civilian employee or military personnel, or a state employee, or even local municipal employees. We are the people who make. We the people in a democracy, we're supposed to look to ourselves to have our government function and operate. And so I've always just held it in high esteem and have always liked the idea of stepping up and trying to do something, for the people through government. A number of jobs I've had over the years, obviously the JAG Corps, 23 years, I just retired at Navy and Navy Reserve a year ago last August. Wow. At one point in my career, I was a special assistant U.S. attorney in the Northern District of Florida, where I prosecuted criminal defendants who violated federal law, including some drug cases. Yeah. In Florida, I got the opportunity to serve as an attorney special magistrate for four Florida counties in the panhandle of Florida, and these four counties actually are larger than the size of Rhode Island probably Delaware combined. Wow. Just huge real estate. So I was an attorney special magistrate. I handled taxpayer appeals of folks who were complaining about their tax bills, and I held hearings and issued written opinions and so forth. And of course, veteran services, where I was deputy secretary and general counsel.
Okay. A little civics 101. What's the role of a state senator?
Well, there's a couple of different views on what is the role of a state senator. There's a lot of people seem to think that, and I think this is really a function of the party system. They think that they exist to do nothing but constituent services. In other words, to do political favors for people who have contributed or done other things for their particular political party. I don't particularly hold that view. I view that there are certain members of the population who should be able to receive constituent services from their state senator for things that they need. But those people are a limited class of people. And I would say that those are our veterans, our elders, our folks with disabilities. Whether children or adult, learning disability, intellectual disability, physical disabilities. And other than that, I really can't see what other members of the population really should be getting special favors from the government through constituent services. My view of the state senator is to, if you're looking, is to basically work with your, the state representatives who are in your district. The senatorial districts are much larger. There are only 40 senators. It consists of, the districts consist of about 163,000 people, whereas the House of Representatives districts are much smaller. Right. Consist of something like 40,000 people. Mm-hmm. Maybe it might be a little more than that. I'm not quite sure. So obviously within this district, the senatorial district, there are four, possibly five representatives. I think the state senator's job is to work with them to identify the needs of the local district and to do what can be done by way of legislation and to help the people of the district and to make sure that the funds are available to fund the needs of what we decide the type of legislation is going to be supported, that we get feedback from the local communities.
You're running as an independent. Where do you sit on the political spectrum, I guess?
Yeah, well, as an independent, and I'd like to just point out, 55% of the Massachusetts registered voters are independent. We are the largest voting block in the state. Yet year after year, we go to the ballot box and we are confronted with, if we're lucky, two choices, a Democrat or Republican. Actually, in Massachusetts, 85 to 90% of the races every year aren't even contested.
Correct.
So chances are, if you are in Massachusetts and you're an independent voter and you walk into the ballot booth, chances are you're going to go into the ballot booth. There's only going to be one name on that ballot, and chances are it's going to be a Democrat, since the Democrats heavily control our legislature. Mm-hmm. So as an independent, I guess what I was just saying, my political views would be that I'm a fiscal conservative, and I'm a social moderate. And I think I'm like most people. I'm like most voters. You know, I think most people are in the middle when it comes to social issues, and most people, you know, are looking to rein in spending and by the legislature. So,
question I've asked every candidate, and it's a comparison question. So, if you can think of a current political figure or a recent political figure, fill in the blank with. If you like blank, you'll like Stephen Gill. Is there a political figure?
Well, you know,
a little relatable.
Yeah, I think I would have to reword that if you don't mind.
Sure, go for it.
I think I would say if you don't like typical politicians, you will love Stephen Gill.
That's fantastic. Let's get talk about the district and some of the issues. What's the biggest issue in your opinion that's facing the district?
Well, the district as a whole, obviously, it's the South Shore, and we're all coastal communities. Norwell is even a coastal community because it has the North River running right through it, and the North River's in the tidal zone. And as you know, with the study that was just done, the Tri-Town study with Duxbury, Scituate, and Marshfield, was that about 4 or 5 years ago? A study was done, and it shows that we're due to have now, in the next 20 years, at the time it was in the next 25 years, but those 5 years have come and gone now. In the next 20 years, we're supposed to have a sea level rise of 1 foot. Now, people say, oh, sea level rise, 1 foot, that's not a big deal. You know, we're not talking about 1 foot on your beach. We're talking about 1 foot across an area where a lot of the land is actually below sea level or is marshland, which means there's going to be a huge sections of real estate throughout this district that are going to be underwater, and that means people's homes, you know, where we spend our time in the summers here. You know, we live in Massachusetts, and, you know, we suffer through these horrific winters and terrible springs, which are always just as cold as the winter, you know, to get 3 months of summer. And what do? We like to go down to the beach and enjoy the outdoors. Well, you know, that's not going to be there much longer. We're going to we're going to have you know, with the sea level rise, we're going to have to take a look at.
What's the approach we need to take?
Well, you know, we've tried in the past, and the Army Corps of Engineers have tried this with the seawalls, weirs, groins, jetties, other types of coastal revetment devices. The problem is with these devices, and they didn't really understand this. It was a function of experience. We put these huge superstructures in that cost, you know, mega dollars, and in today's dollars, astronomical. We put these things in, and we ended up with a bigger problem than we actually solved. We just traded off one type of erosion for another type of erosion. You know, in recent years, there have been some advancements in some of these sea level rise revetment devices, and one of them that looks pretty promising, is fairly inexpensive compared to the other ones, is are the wave attenuation devices, which are giant plastic. And in the Navy, we're used to seeing these things all the time, but around the country, they deploy these devices all over the place. They look like giant snowflakes, and they're strung together on chains or cables. And the way they function is, when the wave action comes in the wintertime, which is when we have our loss of most of our sand, they serve to knock down the wave function below the water level, so that the waves are less harmful in carrying away, you know, what our beaches are. But they're not going to stop sea level rise. They're going to stop the waves from eroding what's there, but we still have the sea level rise issue to deal with, and you know, we could probably look to countries like the Netherlands to deal with what they do every year. But they spend, you know, half their national budget to keep from going underwater because they have to. You know that country shouldn't exist. You know, it's basically swamps that were filled in over the centuries, and you know, we'd have to take a look at it, but that's expensive. We'll have to see what's going to happen with that. That's really a bigger issue. We'd have to really work with our federal delegation in order to fund these bigger projects.
Another issue that comes up is gun laws. What's your take on current gun laws in Massachusetts?
Yeah, well, I support sensible gun laws. You know, as an attorney, I support the entire Bill of Rights and the Constitution. And in fact, in my lifetime, I've had to swear an oath to protect and defend the Constitution something like 18 or 19 times, you know, 13 times for every bar that I belong to, state and federal. And then every time I was promoted in the military, I would have to take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution, as well as, you know, when I was a U.S. attorney, I had to do that as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have a Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, and, you know, the Supreme Court has told us the parameters of that in recent years with a couple of big cases that mm-hmm. came out. I don't know. Bore the listeners to, or the viewers right. to the subject.
We got a bunch of other topics too. We got
right, so. And I'm sorry if I'm talking too long.
No,
I do.
You're
apologize.
Doing great.
So the Massachusetts, as you probably know, has some of the strongest sensible gun laws in the country. I think the most important one that was passed last October was the bump stock and trigger crank ban. I mean, even folks who are staunch Second Amendment supporters, are in agreement that we don't need bump stocks and trigger cranks, mm-hmm. on our weapons at home that we may have. I don't own a weapon, but a rifle or a handgun. But I certainly don't oppose other folks' right to do so.
Veteran service is something near and dear to your heart. Does the state do enough?
You know, Massachusetts has the most robust state benefits program for veterans in the entire country. We are the shining example to the rest of the state. And we actually had the first ones, and we implemented them following the Civil War. So we have a long tradition of this in Massachusetts. Having said that, we can always do more. You know, one of the things that I know we tried to do this when I was at Veteran Services, and when I was out getting signatures earlier this year to be on the ballot, and I had veterans coming up to me talking about it. Everyone was concerned about the, there's a veteran's annuity that gets paid to folks who are either 100% disabled or like Gold Star families who are families whose child has been killed in the military. And that's only $2,000. You get $1,000 after the budget comes out in July, and then 6 months later you get a second $1,000. That needs to be increased, because that is really a pittance for, you know, what someone has given their life, you know, for all of our freedoms, and, you know, $2,000 right. is not a lot of money.
Okay. One of the topics that comes up, if it's a selectman's race, state rep, state senate, probably even governor's race, is the opioid crisis.
Right.
Your thoughts on tackling the opioid crisis?
Yeah, and you know, if you study the history of drug and alcohol addiction in this country, I mean, it goes back over 100 years. Every few generations, we have these massive outbreaks of drug addiction. Of course, you know, with alcohol, we had the temperance movement in the late 1800s. We ended up with the 18th Amendment and mm-hmm. prohibition, and then that, of course, got repealed with the 21st Amendment. But the reason why we have federal drug schedules for substances and the various penalties that are attributable to those types of drugs is because it came out in the 1920s because of the massive drug problems we were having in this country at that time. And of course, the 1960s, I mean, drugs were everywhere. You know, new drugs were coming on the scene. LSD, it wasn't even a scheduled drug. It ultimately became a scheduled drug, but it was used in colleges. You know, Timothy Leary and all that,
right.
Harvard and everything. We're doing experiments and having fun with LSD. But anyway, you know, we have the new problem now because we have the very strong drugs, you know, the fentanyl, and of course the heroin, the grade of heroin that's out these days is just brutally deadly. And, you know, surprisingly, I was surprised to learn this, people can get these drugs through the mail, and it comes from China and Mexico. You can basically just order this stuff on the dark web and order, and it will be basically mailed to your address. So I don't know how you combat that. That seems like a federal issue as far as keeping those drugs out coming through the postal system or other types of private delivery systems that, you know, obviously they don't know it's coming. But we've made great, Governor Baker and the legislature made great steps right after Bob Hedlund resigned this seat Christmas Eve of 2015.
Right.
And before the special election, before Pat O'Connor got elected, the legislature passed that first comprehensive opioid bill where we were limiting the amount of prescription drugs because of these strong drugs that the pharmaceutical companies were putting out, and we're focusing on funding rehabilitation and less on the punishment the crime and punishment aspect of it for the users. We've made that was a tremendous bill, and also with the Narcan and the funding for the Narcan and giving immunity to civil liability to the first responders who mm-hmm. who are administering the Narcan, that they can't be held liable if someone dies because they incorrectly administered the Narcan to recover. Great strides, and we just passed another bill just recently to do more funding and education along these lines. I don't know what more the legislature needs to do other than to continue to fund these programs right. that already exist. Okay. So, you know, it's up to Maura Healey now to continue with her litigation against the drug companies, which could result in a multi-billion dollar windfall to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which in turn we can use to help fund our healthcare system, since a lot of the outlays for drug rehabilitation and medical treatment that people are receiving who are addicted to these drugs due to the wrongful prescriptions of these opioids, this money can go back into the system and help to refund our healthcare, which is always in need of funding from a source.
Economic development's another, you know, big part of, you know, this election. And how would your election help small business or the small business climate in the district?
Well, one thing I would like to do, when you look at Massachusetts industries, in the top five is tourism, which is something that we really need to start focusing on here on the South Shore. We got the Plymouth 400 coming up. We're going to have people from not only all over the country, but all over the world, hopefully, you know, converging on us here. And they're going to need places to dine and drink and sleep in a hotel mm-hmm. overnight and things to do during the day. You know, with the local add-on tax that was passed, where local towns and communities in the hospitality industry can tack on an additional 0.75% to our 6.25% sales tax, and that 0.75% goes directly to the town mm-hmm. where that restaurant or hospitality business is. I think Norwell, Hingham, Weymouth, and I'm not sure if Scituate has, but those are the communities that I'm aware of that have actually passed the local tax right. bill, and that will only increase with trying to pump up the tourism industry here in Massachusetts, especially on the South Shore.
One of the questions that everybody's talking about, and it's on the ballot in November, is question one, the right. nurse staffing question.
Yep.
What's your thoughts on it?
It's always a bad idea when government is trying to tell you how to do something. For example, you know, this proposed question on the ballot is this referendum question is a perfect example. They're trying to tell the people who are the experts in medicine and and nursing and caring mm-hmm. for patients how to actually do that. What it's really going to do is they say they're saying that this is a safety issue, but what they're really doing, it's going to end up in more patients per nurse, which to me translates to worse care. Although they're saying, they're using the word limit, they really mean increase the limit of patients per nurse. I would recommend folks vote no on that.
Okay. We see these ballot questions come up a lot more. Do you think ballot questions are a good way of making or changing laws?
They can be, but you know, sometimes it's a bit of a crapshoot because, for example, you know, the legislature for many years was resisting passing a bill to legalize recreational mm-hmm. marijuana, and of course, there were many good reasons for that. Number one being law enforcement issues because there's no accurate way to measure how high someone is when they're operating a
right.
motor vehicle. Unlike alcohol, you can give a breathalyzer and that alcohol content translates to a degree of impairment where you can have someone convicted for OUI. There's no such test, there's no such scientific test for how much THC
right.
impairs you while driving. So we could have people driving around stoned out of their minds, and we have no scientific way to prove that in a court of law. So I think the legislature was smart for all these years to resist that, but they punted. It got put on the ballot, right, and the folks voted for it, and now we have it. And so now we'll see what that's going to bring us as we move forward. In any event, it can't. Sometimes it's not a good thing to have these referendums. Right. Other times it's a good idea because the legislature doesn't have the will,
right,
to actually pass a law. And this gets back to the idea of why I'm an independent. And political parties have agendas, and the political parties' agendas are not the agendas of the people or the voters necessarily. And so if their political platform and their party opposes a particular type of legislation, then they won't do it. And maybe it is in the best interest of the people, so the people could have a chance to vote on it, to implement it by way of referendum.
We're getting short on time, and because we're always getting to these really hard-hitting issues, we always try to end on a high note of
okay.
the show. So we have some fun questions at the end here.
All right.
First off, if people want to find out more about you, where can they go?
Sure. You can find me online at Gill, G-I-L-L, 4, which is just the number 4.
Number 4.
Senate.org. So okay. Gill4Senate.org. Or you can call me on my cell phone, 781-385-9972. I'll talk to you all day long about any issue you want to hear about.
All right. What's something people might find interesting about you, like a fun fact or something like
fun
that?
Fun fact. Well, you probably wouldn't think so because I've been sitting here talking so stiffly, probably like a lawyer. But I'm actually an outstanding electric guitar player, uh-huh, and I love to play Led Zeppelin, which is very challenging, if you know anything about Jimmy Page and his skills.
Well, this actually perfectly segues into our next fun question is, if we were to take your iPhone or iPod, what music would we find on it?
Well, I don't have an iPhone. I have a Samsung.
Or whatever
music. I don't have any music on there, but I do still, I'm an old man, so I have CDs.
Okay.
And you will find the entire Led Zeppelin collection. You will find The Who. You will find The Beatles. Mm-hmm. You will find all manner of classic rock.
And lastly, why are you the best candidate?
I'm the best candidate because I am a proven leader for my life experience. I am just like you, the voter in Massachusetts. Most of us are independent. I am just like you. I have no political party agenda that I'm going to put ahead of yours. It seems to me in this day and age, and this is kind of goes to the troubles that we have, you see at the national level where the Democrats fight the Republicans like cats and dogs. It's like the Civil War. It's the Union versus the Confederacy, and no prisoners, and nothing gets done. No one can agree with anybody else, and no one can. We can't get anything done. I am someone who is not a follower, I'm a leader. It seems to me the political parties elect followers to toe their party line and follow their agenda, which is not necessarily in the best interest of you, the voter.
Right, well, Steve, I want to thank you for joining us today, and I wish you the best of luck over the next month and a half during the election process.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan, I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And that's all the time we have for Meet the Candidates. And until next time, make it a great day.